back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I am Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Phil Gillette. Phil has worked in movies, TV, comics, and video games. His screen credits include the sci-fi film Europa Report, starring Charlton Copley, the surreal horror thriller They Remain, starring William Jackson Harper, and Netflix's multiple Emmy Award-winning series Love, Death, and Robots, an animated... I would describe it as an animated Black Mirror. I don't know if that is an offensive description to you.
It's not offensive to me,
okay.
No.
Okay, good, good. But it's a solid shorthand. But today, I'm having him on the show because he out of the blue, pitched me to talk about The Spine of Night, the animated film that he co-directed and co-wrote with Morgan Galen King. And I'm almost hesitant to provide a shorthand for this movie, but something like heavy metal by way of Dungeons and Dragons, which may be heavy metal already. I don't know.
Yeah.
But Phil, thank you for being on the show. Let's talk about The Spine of Night and kind of how that came to be. And most importantly, I want to describe it to people because it's a very interesting looking movie. It is a rotoscoped film. You don't see a lot of rotoscope animation anymore. It's all, you know, CGI and the occasional hand drawn thing. But rotoscoping, how does rotoscoping work? Explain to people what rotoscoping is and how you actually do it and make it look like it looks on the screen.
Yeah, so rotoscoping is a very old animation technique, almost as old as animation itself. And basically, at its core, what you're doing is you're filming a live performance, and then you are hand drawing over it to create the look. And hand drawing over it is a little bit reductive because really what you're doing is using that actor's performance as reference for the animation that's going on. So what it creates is an animated look that is different than your standard cartooning. So like there are very, very famous examples of rotoscoping, like the dancing, like it's a technique that the old Disney studio used occasionally. Like they used it for, I believe, the dancing in Sleeping Beauty, I think, is rotoscope. And I think that probably is the movie that has the most of their rotoscoping in it. You can see a little bit of it in, there's like one shot in the old He-Man cartoon that's rotoscoped, but the most famous practitioner of it is Ralph Bakshi, who made the 70s animated Lord of the Rings, and Fire and Ice, which is the movie he made with Frank Frazetta, are very famous examples of it. So and we did it. And then I guess to jump forward a little bit, there are more recent examples like Scanner Darkly and Waking Life are both rotoscope movies, but they're, to my knowledge, they're a combination of some kind of filter and then some hand-drawn animation. For The Spine of Night, we did it the most painful, most time-consuming way you can do it, which is to say we did it like Bakshi did it. So we filmed everybody not in motion capture suits, like literally just in strange-looking white outfits with some like reference lines literally drawn on the clothes, recorded the whole movie that way, cut a very strange live action of it, and then over the course of many years, very painstakingly hand-drew the entire thing. So it's a process.
Yeah. So let me ask, because I assume that, you know, the folks who are credited as actors in this were not wearing the strange white suit. And I mentioned this because you have a very solid cast of voice actors here: Richard E. Grant, Lucy Lawless, Patton Oswalt, Joe Manganiello. I can't ever pronounce his last name. I'm sorry.
I think he says it Manganiello, actually.
Manganiello. Okay, yeah. Great. There we go. But a really great cast of actors here. But I assume they came in after the animation had taken place, right?
Yeah, so that's largely correct, with one exception. Betty Gabriel, who people know from Get Out and from a lot of other great Blumhouse movies, and she was on a TV show with J.K. Simmons, the name of which I can't remember. It was sort of like a multiverse TV show she was on.
Anyway. Counterpart.
Yes, Counterpart. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. So she was actually in our very strange warehouse space and shot with us, but that was before Get Out. We shot that live action reference many, many years ago. So we cast her, I think the day after she graduated from Juilliard, she got on a train and came here to Providence where we shot. And so she actually was in those costumes.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, everybody else came on later to do their voices, which was weird in some sense because we were at that point so deep into the animation that, you know, they had some leeway with their performances, but they also, you know, the process for them was more like doing ADR for a live action film and less like doing, you know, what a more standard animation performance, with some exceptions like Richard E. Grant's character. A lot of his, he wears a mask and a lot of his performance is voiceover. So he had quite a bit of leeway, and we let Patton, because he's so good at that kind of stuff, do some ad-libbing and then rearrange the lips to his performance. But largely they all came on, yeah, late in the process.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about this because I assumed, knowing how a little bit about how rotoscope works, that you basically would have to get them to act to the action on screen, which is, yep, as you say, not how voice acting and animation usually works, right?
Yeah, not at all. But, you know, it is to the credit of the actors that they, you know, the voice actors, that they managed to make those performances their own in ways that were really, I mean, shocking and gratifying to me, because like we lived with those original performances, the motion capture performances that had an audio component to them for years. And so, though, you know, for everybody working on the project, those sort of were the characters. So to then suddenly have Lucy Lawless come and put her own spin on the character, manage to fit the lip sync and also bring a different emotionality to it was really impressive. I mean, kudos to all of them. It was not a standard process for them, but all of them did fantastic work. So,
yeah. Well, let's talk about the movie itself a little bit here, because I will include a trailer in this email so everybody can, you know, watch the trailer and get a small sense of it. But give me the 60-second elevator pitch on The Spine of Night. How would you describe this to somebody if you were trying to convince them to watch it?
Oh, sweet Jesus. Okay. So this is do we swear on this podcast?
You can swear. That's where I will.
This is a fucking hard question, is what this is. Okay. The Spine of Night is a sword and sorcery dark fantasy film that has a vaguely anthological structure. So what you're going to be told are stories from across a vast timeline in a fantasy world. And they largely involve a magical flower that has been stolen from a mountaintop, and the various evil ways that is being used over the ages. It's a story of, to make it sound slightly more interesting, it's a story of a necromancer, a librarian adventurer, a barbarian, three strange assassins who dress like birds, and it's very gory and also very naked. There are more animated dicks in this movie than I can almost guarantee anybody has ever seen.
Yeah. I believe it's not rated, but if it were rated, it would be a hard R shading toward NC-17 probably, yes. hence the no rating.
When we sold the movie, they had the, in the ride, you know, in the short form, it was like, it said in there it needed to be cleared for an R rating. And that was my only pushback on that particular contract, was like, I can't guarantee that we can get an R rating on this movie. And I also don't, given the amount of time it took to animate it, we're not going to cut anything to make it an R rating. So it needs to be R-rated.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to, I assume animating dicks is very time consuming and you don't want to lose that important work.
You can't lose a single dick. It's an important part of the creative process.
This is not a double feature with Encanto with the kids. Don't sit them down to watch it if you rent it on VOD. FYI.
It's a weird thing that I've encountered a lot now in the way that my career has gone, where the perception of animation remains in the United States largely that it's for children. So I've got a number of examples of this, but my favorite example of it is that the movie played in a theater in the small town where I'm from, this small town of Wisconsin. It's like 50,000 people. And I had to ask the theater, will you please play my movie? And they were like, oh yeah, that'd be great. So then like my family who still lives there put it on Facebook, the movie's going to play. And then the pastor of the church that I went to when I was a kid was like, oh, maybe my son can bring my grandchildren to see it. And my brother-in-law, to his credit, had to be like, you know, like edit the post and be like, for the record, this animated film is not for children. Yeah. Please do not, especially if you are a pastor in a church, please do not bring your grandchildren to see this movie. It's not for them.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because it is interesting, the kind of wider world of animation that I think streaming has helped with a little bit, but also just the kind of evolving norms on animation and in films. You work on Love, Death, and Robots, which is a very successful, very popular show on Netflix. Again, it's I would say the shorthand is basically animated Black Mirror. It's a little more complicated than that, but you know, there's a lot of confluence of technology and modernity and how all of that is working against us. You know, I don't. but it is an adult show, even when the animation style is Pixar like, right? It's a very adult minded show. What is the response you get to things like that from, you know, standard audiences, but also studio execs? Are they saying like, oh, we need this to be for kids if this is going to be, you know, shown?
Well, I mean, so for both for Love, Death, and Robots and for Spine of Night, I mean, the idea was always that it was for adults. So you wouldn't get a lot of pushback, you know, once you sort of reach the pitching stage. I mean, for both movies, like Spine of Night was made entirely independently. So we never had anybody say fewer dicks or less nudity or less violence. Love, Death, and Robots, we haven't gotten really any pushback, again, because it was, you know, the pitch was always, this is going to be animation for adults. It's always going to be, you know, in the heavy metal vein. But what you do encounter is like other things that I brought up or other things that I pitched where people don't quite understand what you mean when you say it's animation for adults. Like, infamously, one of my other favorite stories is when we were trying to sell Spine of Night and we were talking to a sales agent and we're like, it's adult animation. And the sales agent was like, oh, adult animation. Great. That's huge, huge right now. But we'd love to see it. And we're like, oh, that's amazing. We're so happy to hear that. And then the next thing they said was, can I watch it with my daughter? And we're like, well, no, you can't watch it with your daughter. And then they were like, well, but my daughter's seen Pinocchio. It's like, well, Pinocchio of the Disney films is relatively dark and adult, but it is, again, there is a ocean of difference between the scary whale sequence in Pinocchio, one of the most beautiful animated sequences ever for the record, and, you know, either Love, Death, and Robots and Spine of Night. I mean, I hope that, you know, both projects and the various other adult animated things that are going on will help expand people's idea of what adult animation can be. Because I do think, in particular, or maybe specifically in America, it is a thing that people just, again, the common perception is, and I think largely it's because of Disney, like these things are, it's a cartoon and therefore it's for kids. I mean, there are, I guess, some exceptions. Like for some reason, if you animate a sitcom like The Simpsons or Family Guy, then suddenly it's okay for it to be, you know, not just for kids, but beyond that, or again, I guess there's some Adult Swim stuff too. But other than that, it's largely relegated culturally, I think, to that's for kids.
Well, but even The Simpsons, right, and Family Guy got pushback at the start because they were like, oh, well, why are you making this show for kids where, you know, there's so much cursing and, you know, bad behavior by the children? Aren't you setting a bad example?
I mean, that's true. Yeah, I had forgotten just my mom wouldn't let me watch The Simpsons for years because she thought I was going to end up like Bart Simpson. Yeah.
Yeah. I was not allowed to watch until the second or third season, I think. My parents were, you know, uncomfortable with it. Let's come back. Let's jump back to making The Spine of Night, because this is a labor-intensive project, as you say. How long have you been doing the actual animation for it? Second question, sorry. Is this a spare time thing? Like you would sit down and do, you know, 30 seconds of animation a night? Or was this an actual
to be entirely upfront, like I can't draw for shit, so I didn't do any of the drawing, but it took but Morgan, my co-director, did the majority of it, and for him it was a full-time gig. For him and a very small team of animators we managed to put together were working on it. I mean, Morgan was working on it for more than full-time for about, I think it took us seven years, roughly.
Wow.
And, you know, that's interesting, too. It took us so long. You know, the art of rotoscoping, to jump back to that for a second, is largely like a discarded aesthetic, is something I keep calling it, which is part of the reason I wanted to make the movie, is because I'm sort of fascinated by that idea of like aesthetics that were a thing, and then for whatever reason, the culture just moved on and was like, oh, we don't like that anymore. So that's always interesting to me. When we tried to put our team together to animate it, we had this sort of heroic vision that we were going to put our first trailer out and there was going to be like this army of rotoscopers who were going to be like, finally, it's time. Our project is here. We know how to do this. That did not happen. what did happen is we, you know, tried to hire people who were trained in more modern forms of animation and tried to get them to work in the process that we developed. And by and large, you know, either they couldn't quite get it or they could get it and they just found it too labor intensive. So, you know, what we ended up doing was winnowing it down to the people that could do the style and were willing to do the style. And it's a very sort of specialized skill set. So it was about 3 or 4 lead animators who did the vast majority of it. Again, over the course of 7 years, we shot the live action in 2014. And then it took a couple months to edit together the live action. So we probably started animating at about the end of 2014 and then finished just before we premiered in March of 2021. So yeah, a long time.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's a crazy amount of time.
Yeah.
So you do the animation and then you send out. Did you send out the like completed cut to folks like Richard Grant and Patton Oswalt, or did you send just the script? I mean, how did that work? Because it's like I said, you guys have a great cast here.
I figured way back when we started that nobody would ever, again, dead aesthetic, right? Nobody's going to make a rotoscope movie, and B, nobody is going to make a fantasy film that's not based on any previous IP, which is what this is. Like, it's entirely its own thing. So by the time we got to the place where we were doing the voice cast, we had a pretty solid, maybe 45 minutes that were like visually completely done. So they had, the animation was done, it was colored and it had our backgrounds in it. So we were able to send that to them so they could see like what the product was going to look like. They understood that it wasn't just, you know, they understood what they were getting into, mm-hmm. and then sent the script. So, and you know, the thing about the rotoscope style is that it was like for a certain type of person, it hits a nostalgia chord, right? Because you know they grew up with heavy metal or they grew up with that backsheet Lord of the Rings, and I think in for a lot of the actors that was it. They were, you know, specifically for Patton and for Joe, you know, they're both sort of dweebs and are well aware of like what we were doing. And just like Joe Manganiello said when we met him to do the voice acting, he was like, oh yeah, I watched the first 5 minutes and thought to myself, this movie was made by crazy people and I want to work with crazy people. And I was like, that's maybe the greatest compliment I could be given specifically for this project. So yeah, so we were able to send them, you know, they knew what they were getting into.
Yeah. Have you gone to Joe's Dungeons and Dragons game?
No, I have not. I am okay. Well aware of it, and I hope one day to go, but I haven't been. No,
sorry, I had to ask. So then, how does the actual recording work? I mean, did these folks record at home and send you tapes? I assume, you know, this is the recording's being done in the midst of the pandemic. I assume everybody's not getting together at a studio somewhere.
Yeah. So for Joe and a couple of the other actors, we recorded them at the end of 2019. So actually like I was in a studio with Joe and some of the others. But for all the other name actors like Patton, Lucy, Richard, Larry Fessenden, and even re-recording Betty, those were all virtual. So mm-hmm. for Betty, we basically tried to do it the real DIY way. Like we sent fancy microphones to everybody. I sent one to Lucy Lawless's house in New Zealand, and I sent one to Richard, and I sent one to, actually Patton didn't need one because Patton has a recording studio in his basement, which is,
that sounds right.
Nice for him. Yeah. So, and then we tried to walk them through the tech setup, and then we would get on a Zoom call and I would direct them, you know, with their microphone, wherever they had. That didn't work out. I mean, Lucy, to her credit, was like, I got your microphone, but you know, I would prefer it to go into a studio because I don't feel comfortable setting the microphone up. And luckily New Zealand was open enough at the time that we managed to get her into a studio, a place that she'd worked before and was comfortable with. So then we were on a Zoom call like with the studio and I could like see and hear her performance. What I couldn't judge was the lip sync because there's like a time delay between image and sound, but you know, it largely turned out great. Richard E. Grant, who's, I mean, just a lovely and fantastic human being. He did try to do the tech setup and then we had to make him do the whole thing over again because it didn't sound good. And that was, I felt so bad. So we made him get, I made him, we asked him if he would please, like, so for the first time we recorded, he was on vacation in the south of France. And I was like, oh, this is great. It'll be fine. He sent it in. Our sound designers were like, this sounds bad. We can't use this. So then I made my producer write a very apologetic email to Richard. And at that point he was back in London and there was a, again, we were like, you know, because they've all done this many times, like, we're like, what's the sound studio that you're comfortable with? Let us know and we'll work with anybody that you're comfortable with. So there was one that he'd worked with that was open, and he went in and that same thing. He was, I think the performance was better the second time, but I definitely was like, oh, he's not happy with me right now. But I think they contributed to the performance. So it was good. Yeah.
Well, it's good. He's great. I mean, the voice work in this is great. And the animation is for a dead aesthetic, it is a very interesting style and one that I think it is the sort of thing that will trigger a lot of nostalgia centers for people who, you know, grew up with kind of dorm room classics like the Bakshi Lord of the Rings and heavy metal and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, some people, it's an interesting thing, the style. Like, I like it, obviously, quite a bit. I guess I love it. I mean, I love all animation, so it just feels weird to single it out. And some people really, really love it, and some people absolutely hate it. Like, some people see it, I'm perfectly willing to acknowledge this. Some people see it and are like, why would you? Yeah. I even have friends who I send it to and like, here, check this movie out. And they're like, oh yeah, that movie was really cool. Too bad about that animation style though. And I was like, I mean, I appreciate your honesty, but it's kind of part and parcel at this point. Like, we can't, we can't do anything else. So.
Yeah. Well, it's different. I mean, it's different. It's just a different look. It is something that takes a little getting used to if you're not used to it. Let's talk about fundraising because this is, you know, it's a long-term project. You know, voice actors aren't working for free, no matter how much they love it, I'm sure. How did you guys actually raise the money for this? Right. Was this,
Yeah, I mean, so we started entirely self-funded, basically. Like, I saw a short film that Morgan had made, again, way back in 2013. And at the time, I'd, you know, been a screenwriter for a little while, but I hated the industry in general. I still have, I think, a pretty fraught relationship with it. But at the time, I was particularly pissed at various things. So I saw his short film and was like, I just sent him an email and said, hey, I love this short film. Let's get together and let's figure out how to do something. And so pretty quickly, the idea became to what would become The Spine of Night. And I mean, I guess, cause I'm an insane person, was like, let's just start. We'll put a little bit of money together. We'll rent the studio. We'll hire some actors. I mean, so that initial live action shoot was not expensive at all because it was, I mean, it was like me and a DSLR, a Canon 4D or something, a couple of lights and some costumes. And, you know, we basically paid those actors not very much, but, you know, fed them well, like did the Wes Anderson thing where like everybody got a nice meal. And it was a very friendly, very fun shoot where it was like, oh, there are D&D books and magic cards and all kinds of nerd stuff. And then we shoot these scenes and it's great. And that model basically carried us through the first couple of years, basically of us. It was self-funded. Like, we would cobble the money together wherever we could. And that would pay Morgan and whatever animators we could hire. And then at a certain point we needed more money because, you know, it's not cheap animation. So it was at that point that we made the decision that we would have to cast up the actors to, you know, to bring some names in. And then those two things sort of happened, you know, like with other movies, it's like you have some people who are like, oh, we can give you some money if you can get some actors names attached. And then, you know, it's sort of like that weird stepladder thing happens where you get the actors and then you get the money and then you can finish the thing. So, and at that point, you know, because we are independently funded, at the beginning, at that point, we were basically able to say to anybody who's going to come on, the project is the project. We're not going to make it less naked or less violent than it is. So either you're on board for what this is or you're not, you know? So that's basically how we put it together.
Well, let's talk about distribution because getting distribution is always hard. It's always a tough thing. How did you guys wrangle that?
Yeah, so we did a pretty traditional like indie film thing, right? Where we submitted to festivals, we got into South by Southwest, and we also at that point had a sales agent, these guys Yellow Veil, who are great. They do a lot of genre stuff, and so then we sold the movie out of South by to RLJ, which was great. It's a perfect home for it. I mean, it is. We're not Mandy, but we're Mandy adjacent. I mean, like, we're very different movies, but I think if you like Mandy, you're probably going to find something to love in Spine of Night. The thing that's been really interesting is, well, a couple things. I mean, I'm going to talk about theatrical, but I also want to talk about international. Like, the international thing, it is fascinating to me. Like, I am a little, like, we've sold some international territories, not all of them. And so what we've ended up doing now is we're working through like an aggregator that was just going to like put us up on iTunes and Amazon and basically everywhere in the world, and then just sort of see how it works, which I'm excited about, but also a little bit nervous about, because, you know, it would be nicer to have, maybe nicer to have a local distributor. The other thing that's fascinating to me is we know that we have a lot of fans in Russia because Morgan's YouTube page gets, like, he can see the analytics. So it's like America's the most watchers. And then below that is Russia. And then there's like a huge drop off for the rest of the country. So, or rest of the world. So, and he gets a lot of Russian comments that he has verified to not be trolls. Like, these are actually Russian people who have watched the movie and are excited about it. But getting distribution in Russia is really, really hard. Like, like shockingly hard. And
you mean theatrical or streaming or both?
I mean anything, like anything. And I can't really explain it. Like, even, you know, my incredulity, I was like, well, you like it, surely there must be an iTunes store in Russia. Like, surely Apple must be in Russia. And as far as I can tell, they are, but, and I swear this is what I've been told, there are two guys who control, it's so Russian, two guys who control the iTunes store for movies in Russia. And you have to call them, and if they pick up, maybe they'll put your movie on the iTunes store in Russia, and maybe they won't. And like, and that's it. So I,
that's very post-Soviet.
It's fascinating. So we're still working on Russia. Like, we have Polish, we have an actual Polish distributor and you know, other East Bloc stuff. But I remain annoyed and frustrated that in the 21st century, you can't just click a button and have your movie up everywhere. Like, it just, it seems like we should be in a place where that's possible.
And is that, that's interesting. I've never had somebody tell me this before, because it is, I guess I've just never thought about it, because I mean, most of the big movies get releases in Russia. I see box office numbers come in from Russia and, but I didn't, I've never really thought about the bureaucracy of getting a, you know, digital release.
It's a thing. It shouldn't be a thing, but it is a thing. It's so weird. And then, I mean, we've been knocking on that Russian door for months now, trying to figure out how to do it. And so far, all of our attempts have been frustrated. We tried to get it released in China too, but I've worked with Chinese companies in video games and stuff. So I've like tried to use my Chinese contacts, and invariably what I get is, oh, you would need to cut this movie severely to even get on any kind of like any kind of release at all. Even to get in a film festival, they're like, you would need to cut basically everything in this movie. Yeah. So that's not going to happen.
Well, that's also interesting. I mean, China, I know a little bit better than Russia. China, the Chinese government is not huge on magic.
No.
And nudity. No. Also.
Nope.
And I imagine the violence is probably.
I was
going to
say everything that is in the movie. Every shot of the movie probably contains one of those three things. So probably not. I mean, the other thing about Russia, I guess, is that they, for whatever reason, just this past year decided to really start to censor animation. Like, they, you can't watch Akira in Russia. Like, Akira came out,
30 years ago.
30 years ago, something like that. And so, so adult animation, I guess, just in general in Russia, for some reason, has become suddenly a thing that the government thinks shouldn't be released. So, anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is that a part of their efforts to stop the, you know, the corruption of the youth? I know that's a big thing in Russia right now.
That's my suspicion. I haven't looked deeply enough beyond the, like, me being annoyed that it affects me personally. I'm selfish enough that, like, you know, I want to corrupt the Russian youth, but I'm not being allowed.
Oh boy. I don't want to get Putin hearing that on this show. Well, it's a really interesting movie. Again, it's not going to be for everyone. And I want to warn people about that right now. But as a lover of animation myself, and as somebody who has always been kind of into rotoscoping, I greatly enjoyed this kind of nostalgic trip. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you want to tell people about the movie, or the world of animation, or just really anything that you think folks should know. What should I have asked? What do you want people to know?
Well, so first of all, I would say I think that 2021 was a little bit of a banner year for indie adult animation in the U.S. Like, we Spine of Night, Dash Shaw's movie Crypto Zoo came out, which was also, you know, an indie animated film. And Phil Tippett finally finished his Mad God movie. So I feel like like, people should just be aware that if they're at all curious about the world of indie American animation, it's out there for them to discover. I guess I would also say, you know, I was gonna say, I don't want to be anti-Disney. Disney's great, but there's a whole other mode of animation for that people, I think, should expose themselves to. Admittedly, the bar for entry for our movie is maybe a little high given the content. But if you're at all curious about, if you're at all a fan of like fantasy films or Game of Thrones, or, you know, remember watching E-Man as a kid, or maybe still play D&D, I think it's probably a movie that that you should at least check out, even if it's just to see if it's your bag or not, you know?
Yeah. Well, let me ask just one follow-up on that. What are some of the best places to go to find non-Disney or DreamWorks animation, right? I mean, there's, we talked about Netflix's, the show you do with Netflix. Yeah. But where else should people go?
The one thing I would add is that there's this whole... One thing we haven't talked about is that, like, you know, this adult animation issue that we've been talking about is really, I think, almost specifically an American issue. Like, if you look at Japan, the Japanese appreciation for animation is obviously a huge age range. So, you know, I guess anime is one place, one obvious place you could go and look. But if you're looking for more domestic stuff, if you go on to Vimeo, the Vimeo streaming site, they do a great job of curating animation. They do like staff picks of their favorites. You could go, if you have the Criterion streaming service, they, I don't know if it's still up, but last month or 2 months ago, they had a really great selection of, it was all just indie animation stuff. You can look at, I mean, there's a number of features that you could watch, like the Bakshi stuff. Son of the White Mare is an older movie that came that just got a really great re-release that you can check out. I think those are the main places that I would suggest, okay. You know? Cool. Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Well, Phil, thank you for being on the show. Again, the name of the movie, The Spine of Night, go check it out. It's on VOD now. You can get it in the United States, not in Russia or China, but if you're listening to this in the United States, you can find it on VOD, the VOD platform of your choice. My name is Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode. See you guys then.